at the rapids of the Maumee River in northwestern Ohio, Wayne won a decisive victory, thus meeting one of the chief complaints of the Western rebels, which was that the army would not or could not provide protection. Word of that victory had not reached Pennsylvania, however, when Washington called out the militia. Nor did Westerners know that Chief Justice John Jay was negotiating for a British withdrawal from the posts in the Northwest, another source of unhappiness, for the frontiersmen believed the British encouraged Indian massacres of American pioneers. Jay's treaty would be signed in London in November 1794, but news did not reach the United States until March 1795. There was a certain irony in the Whiskey Rebellion. Washington, Hamilton, and the other heroes of the American Revolution who were determined to put down this rebellion were espousing a policy that they had once risked their lives to oppose, taxation without representation. For there was no question about the truth of the complaints from the frontier that this excise tax on whiskey was specific to the Westerners and that they were not properly represented in the general government that imposed the tax. Implicit in the rebellion was the idea of secession, a second American Revolution. The rhetoric of the whiskey rebels was all but identical to the rhetoric of Sam and John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Patrick Henry. The logic of the rebellion was the logic of the revolution. Just as the ocean that separated England from America dictated that they should be two nations, so did the mountains separate the East from the West and dictate two nations. But what the West saw as simple political logic, the East saw as riot and rebellion. President Washington had not suffered the rigors of Valley Forge or come out of retirement to serve as the first president in order to preside over the dissolution of the nation or lose ownership of the tens of thousands of acres he owned in the West. Rumors of negotiations between rebels and representatives of England and Spain inspired Washington and Eastern nationalists with military fervor. So determined was the president to put down the rebels that he took the field to review the troops who answered his call. Among those troops was Meriwether Lewis. He was one of the first to enlist as a private in the Virginia Volunteer Corps. Surely a part of his motivation was his lust for adventure and his penchant for roving, but he told himself and his mother that he signed on for the campaign in order to support the glorious cause of liberty and my country. He considered the rebels to be traitors and was delighted that our leading men are determined entirely to consume every atom of that turbulent and refractory spirit that exists among the insurgents. He was hardly alone. Thousands of young men from the Middle States volunteered. They had been children during the Revolutionary War. Throughout their teenage years, they had heard war stories from their fathers and uncles. They envied the older generation its adventures and leaped at this chance to experience the camaraderie of the campfire and the possibility of becoming a hero. They were also well aware that the government had rewarded the Revolutionary War veterans with land warrants in the West. The volunteers, 13,000 of them, marched into Pennsylvania in two columns. The New Jersey and Pennsylvania troops gathered at Carlisle, the Virginians and Marylanders bivouacked at Cumberland. Washington, magnificently mounted and in his full dress uniform, reviewed the troops in each camp and marched with them as far as Bedford. The roll of the drums, the cadence of the march, the glittering new uniforms, the eager young patriots, the thrilling sight of General President Washington at the head of the column, was the way artists of the campaign saw it. The reality was different. As Washington bade farewell and Godspeed, the invasion of western Pennsylvania began. Crossing the mountains through rain and mud proved far more difficult than anyone had imagined. Disease, lack of discipline, insufficient rations, and squabbles about rank and command threatened to dissolve the force. Negotiations over rank, command, uniforms, color, design, and accoutrements occupied far too much of the young officer's time and energy. Where egos and sartorial tastes went unsatisfied, anger welled up. In historian Thomas Slaughter's words, "Honor and ambition often supplanted patriotism as the highest priorities of both the resplendent dragoons riding west and those who petulantly stayed behind." Discipline and desertion were major problems, brought on by the vast gap between officers and privates, of which the most important was that officers could resign their commissions and take a walk, whereas the men were in for the duration. The officers got more and better rations and usually managed to billet themselves in log homes. The men spent the nights in tents or on the open ground. Drunkenness was widespread in the whiskey country, as well as rampant gambling, both punished among the men, ignored among the officers. Each morning, senior officers sent out patrols to round up deserters, then had those who were caught brutally punished with 100 lashes well laid on. The men were inadequately clothed and fed. 1 month into the campaign, many were barefoot. On October 7th, Hamilton lamented that the troops are everywhere ahead of their supplies. Not a shoe, blanket, or ounce of ammunition is yet arrived. Food shortages led to plundering, which harmed relations with civilians along the Army's path and was met with severe punishment. One of Lewis's fellow Virginia volunteers was caught taking a beehive. It cost him 100 lashes. Nevertheless, the desperate men tore down fences for firewood, stole chickens, and, when they could find them, cattle and sheep. Slaughter records, "The journals of officers often read like tourist guides to taverns and scenery along the route, while enlisted men's diaries recounted weeks of hunger and cold." Meriwether Lewis was an exception. Although only a private, he was a planter, a member of the gentry, welcomed into the company of the junior officers of the Virginia militia, who knew that his rank reflected his age, not his station in life. His letters to his mother read like those tourist guides Slaughter described. On October 4th, 1794, from the initial camp in Winchester, Virginia, Lewis wrote his mother. He had only recently arrived, whereas 2 regiments had been for 10 days, "at this school, if I may term it so, where they have been well equipped, tutored, and now cut a most martial figure." Lewis's company, he reported, "shall this day draw all our accoutrements and receive our first lesson." His first experience in camp was all he had hoped for and more. "We have mountains of beef and oceans of whiskey," he told his mother, "and I feel myself able to share it with the heartiest fellow in camp. I had last night the pleasure of supping with all my acquaintances in Captain Randolph's company. They are all well except himself." His spirits were soaring. He signed off, "Remember me to all the girls and tell them that they must give me joy today, as I am to be married to the heaviest musket in the magazine tomorrow." A week later, on the march to Cumberland, he wrote, "I have retired from the hurry and confusion of a camp with my constant companion, Ensign Walker, to write I know not what. I am still blessed with a sufficiency of bodily strength and activity to support the glorious cause of liberty and my country. The lads from our neighborhood are all hearty. Remind Reuben of the charge entrusted to him. Ever believe me with sincerity your dutiful son." As the columns crossed the mountains and began to converge on Pittsburgh, the leaders of the rebellion fled down the Ohio River, headed for Spanish Louisiana. 2 rebels were captured, marched east for trial, and found guilty of treason, but they were subsequently pardoned by President Washington. The show of force had worked. Although the whiskey tax never was collected, land taxes, poll taxes, and tariffs on imported products were collected. Thanks to these, the victory at Fallen Timbers, and Jay's treaty, the threat of a Western secession receded. It did not, however, disappear. In late October or early November, Lewis received a commission as an ensign in the Virginia militia. When that militia marched home, he volunteered to stay on with a small occupying force charged with patrolling and policing western Pennsylvania under the command of General Daniel Morgan. The enlistment was for 6 months. "I am situated on the Monongahela," he told his mother, "about 15 miles above Pittsburgh, where we shall be forted in this winter. I am in perfect health. I am quite delighted with a soldier's life." He was also feeling the responsibility of being older brother and head of the family. "I would wish Reuben to amuse himself with useful books. If he will pay attention, he may be adequate to the task of running Locust Hill the ensuing year." There was to be more to his decision to stay in the Army than his delight at the soldier's life. He informed his mother that, come spring and the end of his enlistment, he would direct my course down to Kentucky, where he intended to speculate in lands. He also planned to pay the taxes on warrant land his mother had inherited from Captain Marx, part of Marx's bonus for his service in the Revolutionary War, so as to prevent its forfeiture to the state as vacant or abandoned land. 2 weeks later, he wrote to ask his mother to send money to pay the taxes on the warrant land and papers proving ownership. He concluded, "I am in perfect health and constantly employed in building huts to secure us from the clemency of the approaching season. Remember me to all the girls of the neighborhood. Your affectionate son." On Christmas Eve 1794, he made his first complaint as an army officer. "I am a more confined overseer here than when at Locust Hill," he wrote, "having been ever since my last letter constantly confined to the hunting department. There is no probability of a cessation of axes until the middle of next month." He was learning one of the chief responsibilities of being an officer, concern for his men. "The situation of the soldiery is truly deplorable, exposed to the inclemency of the winter, which is about this time completely set in, without any shelter more than what 8 men can derive from a small tent. Many are sick, but fortunately few have died as yet." For himself, the best he could do for his Christmas feast was a little stewed beef. "But to my great comfort, I have this day been so fortunate as for the price of $1 to procure a quart of rum for a Christmas dram." Sometime that winter, Reuben wrote Meriwether to inform him that their mother was uneasy about his long absence. On April 6, 1795, Meriwether wrote his mother to "press you by all the ties of parental affection not to give yourself any uneasiness about me, as I can assure you I shall not undertake any enterprise more dangerous than being at Locust Hill." He admitted that, "I have had a pretty severe touch of the disorder which has been so prevalent among the troops, almost certainly diarrhea, but have fortunately been restored to my usual state of health." He was due to be discharged in mid-May, at which time he would go to Kentucky to see to your land and to take advantage of a great opening for acquiring lands. Again, he had advice and orders for Reuben. "Encourage Reuben to be industrious and be attentive to business. Remember me to Aunt and Uncle Thompson and all the girls, and tell them that I shall bring an insurgent girl to see them next fall bearing the title of Mrs. Lewis." That last cryptic line had no follow-up to it, but it may have caused Mrs. Marx considerable concern, or perhaps raised her hopes that her boy would soon settle down. If so, she was about to be disappointed. Instead of taking his discharge in mid-May and going to Kentucky, then home, on May 1, 1795, Lewis joined the regular army with the rank of ensign. That same month, he was vaccinated for smallpox. He received a letter from Reuben, who again told him their mother wished his return to Locust Hill. He replied on May 22nd in some wonderfully convoluted sentences, "So violently opposed is my governing passion for rambling to the wishes of all my friends that I am led intentionally to err and then have vanity enough to hope for forgiveness. I do not know how to account for this quixotic disposition of mine in any other manner, or its being afflicted by any other cause than that of having inherited it from the Meriwether family, and it therefore more immediately calls on your charity to forgive those errors into which it may at any time lead me, though all I shall ask at present is that you will not finally condemn me until next fall, at which time it will be my task personally to plead an excuse for my conduct." In other words, it was all her fault. He signed off, "Your ever sincere, though wandering son." Seldom would he spend more than a winter at one place for the rest of his life. With the end of the Whiskey Rebellion, the ratification of Jay's Treaty and resulting better relations with the British, and the victory at Fallen Timbers, the army of 5,424 officers and men of 1794 was cut back to 3,359. Thus, Lewis received his commission in the regular army at a time when that army was undergoing a sharp reduction, strong evidence that he had made a good impression on his seniors. Of course, they would have known his stepfather, and probably his father, and his lineage generally, which didn't hurt. The army he entered had many officers who were tied by blood or marriage to distinguished families. More than a third were sons of officers in the Continental Army or in the militia during the Revolution. The Army's role was primarily to serve as a frontier constabulary, which caused it to be dispersed into small, isolated garrisons, most with fewer than 100 officers and men. Historian William Skelton, in his authoritative An American Profession of Arms, The Army Officer Corps, 1784-1861, calls these tiny garrisons west of the Appalachian Mountains an archipelago of tiny islets strung along thousands of miles of remote frontier. Discipline was imposed with shocking severity on the enlisted men. Flogging was commonplace, branding somewhat less so, but still used as a disciplinary measure. A court-martial at Fort Defiance in northwestern Ohio found two soldiers guilty of laying their muskets aside and sitting down while on guard duty. They were sentenced to 100 lashes well laid on. Theft of a blanket brought 50 lashes. Striking a non-commissioned officer was a 100-lash offense. Desertion was a major problem, both because so many men gave in to the temptation to run off and lose themselves on the frontier, where they could establish squatters' rights and escape the harsh punishments common to 18th-century soldiers, and because the loss of just two or three men in the small garrisons would badly reduce fighting efficiency in the event of an Indian attack. So desertion was severely punished. When a private ran off from Fort Defiance in the fall of 1795, the officers offered two Shawnee Indians a reward of $10 for bringing him back alive and $20 for his scalp. One of the warriors returned the following day with the soldier's scalp and collected the reward along with many compliments from the officers. On paper, the officer corps was also tightly disciplined. It was governed by Baron von Steuben's Regulations for the Order and Discipline of the Troops of the United States, usually called the Baron and the Rules and Articles of War. Among other things, officers were forbidden to use profanity, express disrespect for their commanding officer or federal or state officials, be drunk on duty or absent without leave, or in any way participate in duels. They were subject to dismissal if convicted of behaving in a scandalous and infamous manner, such as is unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. They were further forbidden to keep mistresses, a habit repugnant to the rules of society, burdensome to the service, ever pregnant with discord, always disgraceful and frequently destructive to men of merit. Most officers cultivated a flamboyant style of life, featuring heavy drinking and wenching. They were allowed at least one soldier from the line as a personal servant or a slave maintained at the expense of the army. Second lieutenants were paid $402 in annual salary, with additional compensation for special assignments, but they had to purchase their uniforms, which were terrifically expensive on the frontier. Skelton comments, "Lower-ranking officers had only a precarious grip on middle-class respectability." Many officers supplemented their pay by speculating in land, taking advantage of their location in the West. They speculated primarily in the bounty land warrants issued to Revolutionary veterans. Skelton found that one of the dominant characteristics of the officer corps was internal dissension. Indeed, seldom has an army been led by a more refractory and contentious group of men. That officer was a rarity whose career was not punctuated by acts of indiscipline and acrimonious controversies with his comrades in arms, many of which led to court-martial or duels. One cause was the isolation and boredom of frontier posts. This was exacerbated because the officer corps was one of the few places in the early republic in which Americans from a variety of regional, religious, ethnic, educational, and social backgrounds mingled in close quarters. Probably more important was the overblown sense of honor of the officers, especially those from the South. Any officer who issued or accepted a challenge to a duel, or served as a second, or even upbraided a fellow officer for refusing a challenge was subject to immediate dismissal. In practice, neither the War Department nor senior officers made the slightest effort to enforce these regulations. General Anthony Wayne, in fact, urged his officers to duel, telling them to find some other mode of settling their private disputes than by troubling the army with courts-martial. There was a logic at work. Duels avoided the expense and inconvenience of frequent courts-martial, and in contrast to duels, courts-martial tended to perpetuate rather than resolve the frequent personal disputes. In the army of 1795, one officer declared, "To be publicly insulted, denounced as not a gentleman in the presence of other officers, and not to seek redress in a duel would subject the insulted party to the scoff and ridicule, and what is worse, the contempt of his brothers in arms." Ensign Meriwether Lewis's first posting as an officer of the regular army was to the 2nd Sub-Legion under General Wayne. Thus, Lewis was present at Wayne's headquarters on August 3, 1795, when the 100 chiefs of the tribes of the Ohio region gave their assent to the Treaty of Greenville. In November, a fever swept through the camp. At one point, some 300 of the 375 men at Greenville were sick. Lewis was one of the fortunate. He assured his mother, "I enjoy perfect health." Although there were as yet no formal political parties in the United States, most officers in the 2nd Sub-Legion, like the officer corps as a whole, were Federalists. One of the most contentious political issues of the day was attitudes toward the French Revolution. Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, despised it. Jeffersonians, soon to be known as Republicans, embraced it. Embraced it so thoroughly, in fact, that many of them copied the French and used the simple title citizen in addressing one another. Lewis was one of these. He addressed his May 22, 1795 letter to his mother, "Citizen Lucy Marks, Albemarle, Virginia." Lewis's views and his drinking soon got him into trouble. On November 6, 1795, he was brought before a general courts-martial at Wayne's headquarters. Charges were brought against him by a Lieutenant Elliot. The first charge, "A direct, open, and contemptuous violation of the 1st and 2nd articles of the 7th section of the Rules and Articles of War." Article 1 read, "No officer or soldier shall use any reproachful or provoking speeches or gestures to another." Article 2 forbade challenging to a duel. The specification in the proceeding charged Lewis with, "Abruptly and in an ungentlemanlike manner, when intoxicated, entering his, Lieutenant Elliot's, house on the 24th of September last, and without provocation insulting him, and disturbing the peace and harmony of a company of officers whom he had invited there." They had argued politics. Lewis had apparently been thrown out. He then presumed on the same day to send Lieutenant Elliot a challenge to fight a duel. When the charges were read to Lewis, he entered a plea of not guilty. Testimony was taken over a period of nearly a week. The officers of the court then rendered their judgment. "We are of the opinion that Ensign Meriwether Lewis is not guilty of the charges exhibited against him, and sentence that he may be acquitted with honor." General Wayne, the court-martial report concluded, "confirms the foregoing sentence, and fondly hopes, as this is the first, that it also may be the last instance in this command of convening a court for a trial of this nature. Ensign Meriwether Lewis is liberated from his arrest." Quite obviously, Ensign Lewis could not continue to serve in the same outfit as Lieutenant Elliot. General Wayne transferred the 21-year-old Lewis to the chosen rifle company of elite rifleman sharpshooters. The captain of that company had Albemarle ties. His family came from Charlottesville, although he had been born in Caroline County, Virginia, 4 years earlier than Lewis. His name was William Clark. His older brother was General George Rogers Clark, the conqueror of the Old Northwest during the Revolution and a close friend of Jefferson. In the fall of 1795, William Clark had been in the Army 4 years and taken part in the Battle of Fallen Timbers. In 6 months, he would resign his commission because of ill health and the press of family business, but during that half year, he and Lewis became great friends and admirers one of the other. So the partnership of Lewis and Clark, destined to become the most famous in American history, began because General Wayne preferred to have his officers fight out their differences in a duel rather than in a court-martial, and therefore found for the man who had issued the challenge rather than the one who had followed the law and brought charges. 2 weeks after his release from arrest, Lewis wrote his mother. He said his promised trip home for a visit had proved impracticable. He issued instructions for his stepbrother. "I desire that Jack may be sent to Mr. Maury as soon as he shall have learnt to read tolerably well, being determined that he shall receive a liberal education if at my own expense. Certainly a generous gesture and another indication of how much he valued education. As to his difficulties with the code of conduct of an officer, Lewis took them in his stride. "The general idea is that the army is the school of debauchery," he wrote, "but believe me, it has ever proven the school of experience and prudence to your affectionate son." He was apparently learning to be less provocative in his politics, however. He addressed the letter to Mrs. Lucy Marks, M-A-R-K-S, not Citizen Lucy Marks, M-A-R-K-E-S. He never could decide how to spell Marks. His army life over the next 4 years gave him enough travel to satisfy even his rambling nature. He covered vast chunks of the west, north and south of the Ohio River, beginning with a reconnaissance through Ohio in the spring of 1796. In October, he marched from Detroit to Pittsburgh with a small escort, delivering dispatches. He got lost twice and ran out of rations. He found some abandoned and rotting bear meat in an old Indian camp and pronounced it very acceptable. In November 1796, he transferred to the 1st U.S. Infantry Regiment. That month, he made another march from Detroit to Pittsburgh, again carrying dispatches for General Wayne. This time, he did not get lost, perhaps because he was accompanied by a Wyandotte Indian who probably served as a guide. The Indian's name was Enos Coon, and Lewis paid his bill at a Pittsburgh inn. Following that journey, he took a furlough and rode home to Locust Hill, his first time there since he left in August 1794, promising his mother to return in 6 months. No anecdotes survive from the visit, but apparently he made the rounds of his old friends after satisfying his mother's desire to know about his adventures and arranging his business affairs at the plantation. Invited to join the Virtue Lodge No. 44 of the Masonic Order in Albemarle, he did so on January 28, 1797. He advanced through Masonic degrees with dizzying speed. By April 3rd, he was the recipient of the degree of Past Master Mason. Because his military duties kept him out of Albemarle most of the time over the following years, he attended few lodge meetings, although he was present in June and July 1798 while on furlough. He was an officer in the lodge and that summer made a motion to earmark a portion of lodge funds for charity. By October 1799, he was a Royal Arch Mason. He apparently took the ritual and idealism of the Masons quite seriously. He later gave names taken from Masonic ritual to Western rivers: philosophy, wisdom, and philanthropy. William Clark joined the Masons in St. Louis in 1809. Lewis's furlough extended through the summer of 1797, during which time he settled my domestic concerns. He made arrangements to bring some of his mother's slaves, still in Georgia, back to Virginia, made a trip to Kentucky to do some additional speculating in land. He bought 2,600 acres for himself at 20 cents per acre, telling his mother, "I am much more pleased with this country than I supposed I should." Sold some of his Virginia land to his brother Reuben, bought some of Captain Marks's land from his mother, and generally acted as Virginia planters did in those years, making himself land rich and cash poor. In an age of powdered wigs, lace, and ruffles, he was something of a fop. In a January 15, 1798 letter to a friend, Lieutenant Ferdinand Claiborne, he complained about his tailor. "Of all the damned pieces of work," he wrote, "my coat exceeds. It would take up 3 sheets of paper, written in shorthand, to point out its deficiencies, or I may even say deformities. The lace is deficient. Could I have done without it, I should have returned it." In a postscript, he made a complaint about a military matter, a complaint that virtually every officer in every army in every age has made. "No doubt you have had forwarded to you the late regulation of our generous Congress relative to the delivery and distribution of fuel and straw to the garrisons. The allowance falling so far short of what is really necessary, I am at a loss to determine what steps to pursue. Do let me know what plan you adapt, as I am confident the proportion of fuel is so small that the soldiers cannot subsist on it." In 1798, John Adams was president. Thanks to Jay's treaty, relations with England were good, which meant that relations with France were bad. There was an undeclared war on the high seas. French Foreign Minister Talleyrand demanded a bribe from an American mission. Public opinion was outraged. Political parties were formed around these events, which ushered in one of the most bitterly partisan periods in American history. At the center of the disputes was the size of the army. The High Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, hoped to use the crisis of a threatened war with France to build a classic European-style standing army, meaning one designed more to suppress internal dissent than to repel foreign invasion. Hamilton, and to a lesser extent Washington and Adams, who were not High Federalists, regarded the Republican opposition to government policy, led by Jefferson, as illegitimate, even treasonous, an attitude that led to the Alien and Sedition Acts. In July 1798, the Federalist-controlled Congress voted for a huge increase in the army, authorizing as many as 10,000 regulars and 30,000 militia. To President Adams and other Federalist leaders, the appointment of men of sound politics to the officer corps of the new army was crucial if that army was to provide a reliable check on internal disorder. As active politicians, Adams and his friends were also aware of the vast patronage possibilities in the expansion of the army. But the Federalist Party was divided internally between Hamilton's High Federalist faction and Adams's supporters, so a struggle for power lay ahead. Adams appointed Washington to command the new army, with the rank of lieutenant general. Washington, reluctant to end his retirement, did so only partially, for he insisted on remaining at Mount Vernon until war actually began. That decision meant that the second in command would have effective control of the new army. A series of cabinet intrigues followed that soon embroiled Adams and Washington in a controversy over Hamilton. Eventually, Washington forced Adams to make a humiliating concession, threatening to resign unless Adams agreed to make Hamilton the second in command. The humiliation caused Adams to have second thoughts about the expansion of the army. As a consequence, it did not grow to anything remotely approaching the authorized strength. In practice, there was a rapid increase in the officer corps, but almost none in the enlisted ranks. That meant that Adams still had many commissions to hand out, and they were eagerly sought. Federalists naturally got the lion's share. Washington established the criteria. He proposed giving first priority to active revolutionary veterans, and the second to young gentlemen of good families, liberal education, and high sense of honor. In no case, Washington told Adams, should he appoint any who are known enemies to their own government, for they will certainly attempt to create disturbances in the military. Adams went so far in excluding applicants suspected of republicanism that even Hamilton thought he had gone too far. Hamilton said that some at least of the junior officers should come from the opposition ranks. It does not seem advisable to exclude all hope and give to appointments too absolute a party feature. Military situations, on young minds particularly, are of all others best calculated to inspire a zeal for the service and the cause in which the incumbents are employed. In other words, young Republicans of promise and talent could be won over if given a commission. Adams tended to ignore Hamilton. The vast majority of appointments went to Federalists. Even though they were officers without an army, their political orientation struck fear in the hearts of the Republicans, who talked, somewhat wildly, about the coming Federalist terror. The involvement of the army in politics and the use of the officer corps as a major patronage source was destined to have a decisive impact on Meriwether Lewis. It began with a promotion. On March 3, 1799, he became a lieutenant and was posted to recruiting duty in Charlottesville, which must have pleased his mother. After Adams made his decision to ignore the authorization to increase the enlisted ranks of the army by several thousand, Lewis's recruiting duties ran out. In 1800, he was posted to Detroit, where he joined a company commanded by his friend Captain Claiborne. It was a presidential election year, with Jefferson challenging Adams. Lewis indulged in vigorous political argument, on at least one occasion exchanging hot words with the Federalist officer and overwhelming, at least to his own satisfaction, the Fed with his own Jeffersonian Republican arguments. He shortly became regimental paymaster. This was a new post provided for by Congress in March 1799 as part of the expansion. He got the appointment, Jefferson later wrote, because he always attracted the first attention where punctuality and fidelity were requisite. It was an ideal posting for Lewis for two reasons. The first was personal. His duties gave him a veritable carte blanche for rambling. The second was political. The rambling gave him an opportunity to get to know the officers scattered throughout the West and to assess their political views, thereby acquiring knowledge that soon became a great asset. He roamed the West, up and down the Ohio River, Cincinnati, Fort Wayne, Limestone, Maysville, Chillicothe, Wheeling, on a 21-foot bateau or keelboat and a pirogue. He learned the craft of a waterman on Western rivers. He traveled by horseback to forts south of the Ohio, riding through the wilderness carrying large sums in banknotes, not hard currency, which was too bulky. He kept extensive records, transfers, AWOLs, deserters, recruits. He established a reputation for thoroughness, accuracy, and honesty. On December 5, 1800, Lewis was promoted to captain. That month, the state selected their delegates to the Electoral College. In February 1801, those delegates created a political crisis when the count came out 73 votes each for Jefferson and his running mate, Aaron Burr of New York, with 65 votes for Adams. The tie threw the election into the House of Representatives, where another deadlock followed, as the Federalist Caucus decided to back Burr. In other words, the Federalists would not accept the outcome of the election, in which the people's choice of Jefferson was clear. So intense was the partisanship of the day, so much did the Federalists hate and fear Jefferson, that they were ready to turn the country over to Aaron Burr. Had they succeeded and made Burr the president, there would almost certainly be no republic today. Fortunately for all, Hamilton was smart enough and honest enough to realize that Jefferson was the lesser evil. He used his influence to break the deadlock. On the 36th ballot, February 17, 1801, Jefferson was chosen president and Burr was elected vice president. It was an age marked by a certain extravagance of language. What the alarmists among the Federalists feared, they said, was the general ascendancy of the worthless, the dishonest, the rapacious, the vile, the merciless, and the ungodly. Such sentiments emboldened Adams to radical measures. On March 3rd, hours before Jefferson's inaugural, Adams made his famous midnight appointments, stuffing the federal courts with Federalist judges. Not so well known, but equally outrageous, at least to the Republicans, was his commissioning of 87 men to fill vacancies in the 6 regiments of the permanent military establishment. Virtually all were Federalists, thus guaranteeing that the Army, like the courts, would remain predominantly Federalist for years to come. Or so, at least, Adams hoped. President Jefferson had other ideas. To implement them, he turned to his neighbor, Captain Meriwether Lewis of the 1st Infantry. Chapter 4. Thomas Jefferson's America, 1801. When Thomas Jefferson took the oath of office as the 3rd President of the United States on March 4, 1801, the nation contained 5,308,483 persons. Nearly 1 out of 5 was a Negro slave. Although the boundaries stretched from the Atlantic to the Mississippi River, from the Great Lakes nearly to the Gulf of Mexico, roughly 1,000 miles by 1,000 miles, only a relatively small area was occupied. 2/3 of the people lived within 50 miles of tidewater. Only 4 roads crossed the Appalachian Mountains, one from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, another from the Potomac to the Monongahela River, a third through Virginia southwestward to Knoxville, Tennessee, and the fourth through the Cumberland Gap into Kentucky. The potential of the United States was, if not limitless, certainly vast, and vastly greater if the nation could add the trans-Mississippi portion of the continent to its territory. In 1801, however, it was not clear the country could hold on to its existing territory between the Appalachians and the Mississippi, much less add more western land. Fewer than 1 out of 10 Americans, about 500,000 people, lived west of the Appalachian Mountains, but as the Whiskey Rebellion had shown, they were already disposed to think of themselves as the germ of an independent nation that would find its outlet to the world marketplace not across the mountains to the Atlantic seaboard, but by the Ohio and Mississippi River system to the Gulf of Mexico. This threat of secession was quite real. The United States was only 18 years old, had itself come into existence by an act of rebellion and secession, had changed its form of government just 12 years earlier, and thus was in a fluid political situation. In addition, it seemed unlikely that one nation could govern an entire continent. The distances were just too great. A critical fact in the world of 1801 was that nothing moved faster than the speed of a horse. No human being, no manufactured item, no bushel of wheat, no side of beef, or any beef on the hoof for that matter, no letter, no information, no idea, order, or instruction of any kind moved faster. Nothing ever had moved any faster, and as far as Jefferson's contemporaries were able to tell, nothing ever would. And except on a racetrack, no horse moved very fast. Road conditions in the United States ranged from bad to abominable, and there weren't very many of them. The best highway in the country ran from Boston to New York. It took a light stagecoach, carrying only passengers, their baggage, and the mail, changing horses at every way station, 3 full days to make the 175-mile journey. The 100 miles from New York to Philadelphia took 2 days. South of the new capital city of Washington, D.C., there were no roads suitable for a stagecoach. Everything moved on horseback. Of 8 rivers between here, Monticello, and Washington, Jefferson wrote in 1801, 5 have neither bridges nor boats. It took Jefferson 10 days to go the 225 miles from Monticello to Philadelphia. To the west, beyond the mountains, there were no roads at all, only trails. To move men or mail from the Mississippi River to the Atlantic seaboard took 6 weeks or more. Anything heavier than a letter took 2 months at least. Bulky items, such as bushels of grain, bales of fur, barrels of whiskey, or kegs of gunpowder, could be moved only by horse, ox, or mule-drawn wagons, whose carrying capacity was severely limited, even where roads existed. People took it for granted that things would always be this way. The idea of progress based on technological improvements or mechanics, the notion of a power source other than muscle, falling water, or wind, was utterly alien to virtually every American. Writing in the last decade of the 19th century about conditions in the year of Jefferson's inaugural, Henry Adams observed that, "Great as were the material obstacles in the path of the United States, the greatest obstacle of all was in the human mind." Down to the close of the 18th century, no change had occurred in the world which warranted practical men in assuming that great changes were to come. Jefferson was an exception. He had a marvelous imagination. Monticello was stuffed with gadgets he had invented. He also had developed practical devices for the general good of mankind. Farmers in Europe and America up to the end of the 18th century had used wooden plows with straight mold boards that showed no improvement over those of the ancient Romans. It was Jefferson who developed the curved mold board plow. In 1793, he saw a hot air balloon ascent. Though it was presented as an entertainment, he at once saw a potential practical application. "The security of the thing appeared so great," he wrote to his daughter Martha, "that I wish for one sincerely to travel in, as instead of 10 days, I should be within 5 hours of home." With regard to travel by air, Jefferson was a full century ahead of the curve. With regard to travel by land, he imagined the possibility of locomotion by something other than horsepower. He was attracted by the idea of using steam power to move carriages. In 1802, he predicted, "The introduction of so powerful an agent as steam to a carriage on wheels will make a great change in the situation of man." Jefferson was 100 years ahead of the automobile, however powered. He never saw a train. With regard to travel by water, Jefferson in 1801 could not imagine any way to overcome the difficulties or to improve the advantages of this most essential means of transportation for commerce. At the beginning of the 19th century, all heavy items or items in any quantity moved over water, either in canoes powered by human muscle, or on rafts floating down rivers, or on barges on canals drawn by mules, or on sailing ships propelled by the wind. Because the movement of commerce was by water, Americans of 1801 were constantly thinking about water. Their heads were full of schemes to build canals, using locks to advance upriver or to go around rapids. Jefferson wrote of a people occupied as we are in opening rivers, digging navigable canals, making roads. Since the birth of civilization, there had been almost no changes in commerce or transportation. Americans lived in a free and democratic society, the first in the world since ancient Greece, a society that read Shakespeare and had produced George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, but a society whose technology was barely advanced over that of the Greeks. The Americans of 1801 had more gadgets, better weapons, a superior knowledge of geography, and other advantages over the ancients, but they could not move goods or themselves or information by land or water any faster than had the Greeks and Romans. In Henry Adams's words, "Rip Van Winkle, who woke from his long slumber about the year 1800, saw little that was new to him except the head of President Washington where that of King George had once hung." Describing the mindset of the time, Adams wrote, "Experience forced on men's minds the conviction that what had ever been must ever be." But only 60 years later, when Abraham Lincoln took the oath of office as the 16th President of the United States, Americans could move bulky items in great quantity farther in an hour than Americans of 1801 could do in a day, whether by land, 25 miles per hour on railroads, or water, 10 miles an hour upstream on a steamboat. This great leap forward in transportation, a factor of 20 or more, in so short a space of time, must be reckoned as the greatest and most unexpected revolution of all, except for another technological revolution, the transmitting of information. In Jefferson's day, it took 6 weeks to move information from the Mississippi River to Washington, D.C. In Lincoln's, information moved over the same route by telegraph, all but instantaneously. Time and distance, mountains and rivers, meant something entirely different to Thomas Jefferson from what they meant to Abraham Lincoln. Rivers dominated Jefferson's thinking about North America. For the immediate future, he was determined to get control of New Orleans for the United States so as to prevent the West from breaking away from the United States. Beyond that, he sought an all-water route through the unexplored western two-thirds of the continent. When Robert Gray sailed Columbia into the estuary of the river he named for his ship and fixed its latitude and longitude, mankind knew for the first time how far the continent extended. Knowing the exact location of the mouth of the Columbia represented a great triumph of 18th-century science and exploration. Most closely associated with England's Captain James Cook, the second great age of discovery had used the sextant and other navigational devices to delineate the continents and the seacoasts of the world, the great harbors and the mouths of the great rivers, with precision on the map, and with descriptions of the landforms and native people. What remained to be discovered on Earth was the interior of Africa, Australia, the Arctic and Antarctic, and the western two-thirds of North America. The latter was most important to Europeans and Americans. It was known to be vast, some 2,000 miles from the Mississippi River to the mouth of the Columbia. It was known to contain a wealth of furs. It was presumed to contain immense quantities of coal, salt, iron, gold, and silver. It was assumed that the soil and rainfall conditions were similar to those in Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee, which is to say, ideal for agriculture. But what was not known, or what was assumed but was badly wrong, was more important than what was known. Donald Jackson, the great Lewis and Clark scholar, points out that although Jefferson had the most extensive library in the world on the geography, cartography, natural history, and ethnology of that awesome terra incognita west of the Mississippi, when he took the oath of office in 1801, he believed these things: that the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia might be the highest on the continent, that the mammoth, the giant ground sloth, and other prehistoric creatures would be found along the upper Missouri, that a mountain of pure salt a mile long lay somewhere on the Great Plains, that volcanoes might still be erupting in the badlands of the upper Missouri, that all the great rivers of the West, the Missouri, Columbia, Colorado, and Rio Grande, rose from a single height of land and flowed off in their several directions to the seas of the hemisphere. Most important, he believed there might be a water connection, linked by a low portage across the mountains, that would lead to the Pacific. Louisiana in 1801, that part of North America lying between the Mississippi River and the Rocky Mountains, was up for grabs. The contestants were the British coming out of Canada, the Spanish coming up from Texas and California, the French coming up the Mississippi-Missouri from New Orleans, the Russians coming down from the Northwest, and the Americans coming from the East. And, of course, there were already inhabitants who possessed the land and were determined to hold on to it. There were scores of Indian tribes living across Louisiana, but given their lack of effective political organization, their inability to combine forces into an alliance, their utter dependence on whites for rifles, and the experience of Americans east of the Appalachians in the 17th and 18th centuries, and in Kentucky and Ohio in the 1790s, it could be taken for granted that the conquest of the Indian tribes would be bloody, costly, time-consuming, but certain. Jefferson's attitude toward Indians was the exact opposite of his attitude toward Negroes. He thought of Indians as noble savages who could be civilized and brought into the body politic as full citizens. In 1785, he wrote, "I believe the Indian then to be in body and mind equal to the white man." He thought the only difference between Indians and white men was religion and the savage behavior of the Indians, which was caused by the environment in which the Indian lived. Never did he say that the perceived shortcomings of the Negro, such as laziness or thievery, were caused by their condition as slaves. Keenly interested in Indian ethnology, an avid collector of Indian vocabularies, he had not the slightest interest in African ethnology or African vocabularies. When Jefferson or young Virginians like Lewis and Clark looked at an Indian, they saw a noble savage ready to be transformed into a civilized citizen. When they looked at a Negro, they saw something less than a human, something more than an animal. Never in their lives did they imagine the possibility of a black man's becoming a full citizen. William Clark tried to adopt a part Indian boy as his own son. He would not have dreamed of adopting a black boy as his own son. Spain claimed to own Louisiana, which was roughly defined as that part of the interior of the continent drained by the Missouri River and the southwestern tributaries of the Mississippi River. But, except for a handful of weak garrisons scattered along the Mississippi and anchored by New Orleans in the south and St. Louis in the north, Spain had no effective force in the empire. The British had fur trading interests in upper Louisiana and a claim of sorts to the Oregon country west of the Rockies. The Russians had interests in the area around and north of the mouth of the Columbia. The Spanish had some vague claims to the entire Pacific coast. The French, who had once owned Louisiana and whose people, French Canadians, were the only white men to have much experience in Louisiana, were considering reasserting their position. But European ambitions for the inland empire were more theoretical than real, partly because the chief concerns of the contestants were their wars with one another within Europe, even more because of time and distance, mountains and rivers. In 1801, the European nations were no more capable of exploring, conquering, settling, and exploiting the western two-thirds of North America than they had been in the preceding three centuries. Nor was the United States, not immediately anyway, but Mr. Jefferson's America had two great advantages over its European rivals. First, citizens of the United States were crossing the Appalachians and settling in the Ohio country, right up to the eastern bank of the Mississippi. Indeed, a handful of Americans had already crossed the Mississippi to settle, most of them illegally, in upper Louisiana. Americans, in short, were beginning to take physical possession of lands to which the Europeans had only claims or hopes. The second great advantage was that the United States had Thomas Jefferson for its leader. But on the day of Jefferson's inaugural, frontiersmen west of the mountains could move their bulky agricultural products to market only by river, which meant via the Ohio-Mississippi route. That economic fact dictated politics. The Americans of the West would join Spain, France, or Britain, or whoever controlled New Orleans, or create their own nation and take New Orleans for themselves. Vice President Aaron Burr was full of plots and schemes and conspiracies to break the West loose from the United States and form a new nation. Jefferson would have none of it. He believed in what he called an empire of liberty. Our Confederacy must be viewed as the nest from which all America, North or South, is to be peopled, he wrote even before the Constitution was adopted, and as president he said that he awaited with impatience the day when the continent would be settled by a people speaking the same language, governed in similar forms, and by similar laws. In an age of imperialism, he was the greatest empire builder of all. His mind encompassed the continent. From the beginning of the Revolution, he thought of the United States as a nation stretching from sea to sea. More than any other man, he made that happen. His motives were many. He sought greatness for himself and for his nation. He rejected the thought of North America's being divided up into nation-states on the European model. He wanted the principles of the American Revolution spread over the continent, shared equally by all. He was one of the principal authors of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, as revolutionary a document as his Declaration of Independence. The ordinance provided for the admission into the Union of from 3 to 5 states from the territory east of the Mississippi and north of the Ohio, when the territories had a large enough population. These states would be fully equal to the original 13. Thanks to Thomas Jefferson, the United States would be an empire without colonies, an empire of equals. The ordinance helped bind the trans-Appalachian region to the United States. What mountains and rivers threatened to drive asunder, Jefferson helped to overcome through a political act. But it was not just the largeness of his mind that made Jefferson an imperialist. One of his basic motives was land hunger. Jefferson and his fellow Virginia planters made their living through tobacco and slavery, and tobacco and slavery demanded the unending acquisition of new land. Jefferson's actions as wartime governor of Virginia showed more clearly than anything else the centrality of Western lands to his politics. He was elected governor in 1779. The next year, the British invaded the Carolinas. Virginia was in no position to aid its beleaguered neighbor states to the south because Jefferson had invested Virginia's military resources in George Rogers Clark's campaign to conquer British outposts in the region north of the Ohio River. Jefferson's passion to take full possession of Western lands almost cost the United States their independence. As a politician, Jefferson was keenly sensitive to the needs and dreams of his constituents. In Virginia, his supporters were small farmers, men who after the Revolution were apprehensive about the obvious trend to ever larger plantations tilled by slave labor. They looked to the West for new and cheaper lands, especially in the rich virgin soil beyond the mountains. There, they could raise bumper crops that could be sent quickly to the world market via the fabulous river system of the Ohio-Mississippi. While the Northwest territories were being settled, in Jefferson's view, the Trans-Mississippi Western Empire could serve as a vast reservation for Indians displaced from east of the river. There, they could learn to farm and become civilized so that they could be incorporated into the body politic. Eventually, Louisiana would be available for farmers emigrating from the east or immigrating from Europe. There was land enough for all in a United States stretching from sea to sea, land enough to sustain the American dream for centuries to come. Henry Adams wrote, "Jefferson aspired beyond the ambition of a nationality and embraced in his view the whole future of man. He wished to bring a new era. In 1801, he set himself to the task of governing with a golden age in view." The Spanish might have title to Louisiana, the French might have interests in Louisiana, the British might have designs on Louisiana, the Spanish and French and Russians and British might be contemplating exercising vague titles to or otherwise meddling in Oregon, but in Jefferson's mind it would all be part of the United States in due course. Most of his countrymen agreed with him. Like him, they thought big. Henry Adams described the American of 1801 in these words. "Stripped for the hardest work, every muscle firm and elastic, every ounce of brain ready for use, and not a trace of superfluous flesh on his nervous and supple body, the American stood in the world a new order of man." Adams was generalizing, but he could have been describing Meriwether Lewis. Chapter 5. The President's Secretary, 1801 to 1802. On February 23, 1801, 11 days before his inauguration, President-elect Jefferson wrote Captain Lewis. He said he needed a secretary, not only to aid in the private concerns of the household, but also to contribute to the mass of information which it is interesting for the administration to acquire. "Your knowledge of the Western country, of the army, and of all its interests and relations has rendered it desirable that you should be engaged in that office." The salary would be only $500 per year, scarcely more than the pay and rations that Lewis would have to relinquish, although Jefferson assured him that he would retain his rank and his right to promotion. Further, service as the president's secretary would make you know and be known to characters of influence in the affairs of our country and give you the advantage of their wisdom. He would live in the president's house as you would be one of my family. Jefferson wrote a job description. The office is more in the nature of that of an aide-de-camp than a mere secretary. The writing is not considerable because I write my own letters and copy them in a press. The care of our company, execution of some commissions in the town occasionally, messages to Congress, occasional conferences and explanations with particular members, with the offices and inhabitants of the place where it cannot so well be done in writing, constitute the chief business. The president's secretary would be paid from the president's private funds and provided with a servant and a horse, also at the president's expense. The post has been solicited by several who will have no answer till I hear from you. He requested an immediate reply. It took almost 2 weeks for Jefferson's letter to reach Lewis in Pittsburgh. On March 7th, Lewis expressed his joy in a letter to his company commander, tent mate and fellow Virginian, Captain Ferdinand Claiborne. I cannot withhold from you, my friend, the agreeable intelligence I received on my arrival at this place, Pittsburgh, by way of a very polite note from Thomas Jefferson, the newly elected President of the United States, signifying his wish that I should accept the office of his private secretary. This unbounded as well as unexpected confidence, conferred on me by a man whose virtue and talents I have ever adored, and always conceived second to none, I must confess did not fail to raise me somewhat in my own estimation, insomuch that I have almost prevailed on myself to believe that my abilities are equal to the task. However, be that as it may, I am resolved to accept it, and shall therefore set forward to the city of Washington in a few days. I deem the prospect too flattering to be neglected by a man of my standing and prospects in life. He closed the euphoric letter with a hint of his instinct for politics, along with the